It is a real pleasure to be here. It's a very real honor to be asked to address this group. It's a very impressive institution. I'm happy to be here. I do have to confess that, unlike Fred, I am a lawyer. Please give me a break during these discussions. Also, consistent with what Anita was talking about, I am going to be trying to rejuvenate a discussion that could be called a cross-disability discussion, because as you can see from my title, I'm going to be talking about mental disability and deprivations of liberty and property, and something called the Convention on the Rights of People with Disability. Now, how many people have heard about the convention?
Yay.
All right. That's terrific. And I expected to see that many hands in the audience. Now, a couple of weeks ago, I was talking to a large group of lawyers and mental health professionals who work within the criminal justice system, and virtually none of them had heard of the convention, which I think is stunning, but also not entirely surprising. It's stunning because, of course, the convention was promulgated by the United Nations way back in 2006, and since then, 150 countries have ratified it. President Obama signed it in 2009, and even though it didn't get through the Senate, it only lost in the Senate by 5 votes, and there are currently attempts to reintroduce it. So I think it's very important to talk about the convention for that reason alone. But it's also important to talk about the convention because the provisions of the convention are very similar to the provisions of the Americans with Disabilities Act. So it's very important to talk about it at this particular conference. Because what the convention says, as probably all of you know, is that there may be no discrimination based on physical or mental disability. Now, in particular, I want to focus on the convention's impact on laws that have to do with mental disability, and specifically laws that have to do with mental disability and deprivations of liberty and property. Because here, I think the provisions of the convention are truly radical. Basically, what they can, at least based on what we usually think of as mental health law, they're truly radical, because what it would mean is that we would need to get rid of all laws that are based on mental disability, that have mental disability as a predicate. Now, there are literally hundreds of these kinds of laws, right? We have civil commitment, involuntary hospitalization of people with mental illness on dangerous to others or danger to self grounds. We have the insanity defense. We have guardianship laws. We have laws that allow hospitalization of people found incompetent to stand trial. The convention would require that all these laws be abolished and instead be reframed in terms of disability-neutral criteria. Now, that's a very significant agenda, and I think it's worth spending a lot of time on. And again, it's consistent, I think, with the way the Americans with Disability Act ought to be construed. What the convention does not do is give us a good idea of how its principles would be implemented. It doesn't provide detail, and that's what I want to try to do this morning, is provide, if you will, some statutory language, which would be a way of implementing the non-discrimination policy of the convention. So let's start with what the key provisions of the convention are. There are essentially two that are relevant to what I'm talking about. The first is Article 12. And this is what the article says. States shall recognize that persons with disabilities enjoy legal capacity on an equal basis with others in all aspects of life. Okay, that's a basic non-discrimination statement. What does this mean? Well, the official commentary to the convention states that one thing this means is that all special defenses based on mental disability must be abolished. That means we have to get rid of the insane defense. Why? That's a special defense for people with mental disability. That must be eliminated. In addition, this provision means that we need to get rid of guardianship laws that are based on mental disability, as well as laws that allow hospitalization of people who have been found incompetent as a result of mental disability. Well, what's to take the place of guardianship laws and incompetency laws? What the official commentary says is what should take the place of these laws is something called supported or supportive decision making, which many of you may have heard of. What this particular process entails is that the individual is still to be, or is to be, the ultimate decision maker on any issue that's to be decided. But the individual can be aided by professionals who can try to make the decisions as autonomous as possible. But the important point is the ultimate decision maker is the individual, not some third party. That's what is to replace guardianship and incompetency laws. So that's Article 12. Then there's Article 14, and as what that article says is the existence of a disability shall in no case justify a deprivation of liberty. What does this article require? As the commentary says, this article outlaws detention grounded in the combination between mental or intellectual disability and other elements such as dangerousness or care and treatment. So, in effect, what this article requires is the abolition of both police power commitment, that is commitment based on mental disability and dangerous to others, and parens patriae commitment, that is commitment based on mental disability and danger to self. Now, again, these are pretty radical provisions. It basically blows up mental health law. It gets rid of all of mental health law as we've come to know it. So how could it possibly be implemented? How could these provisions possibly be implemented? And that's what I'm going to try to discuss today. I hope maybe I've come to the rescue, because what I've tried to do in this book that you see here is try to explain how the principles underlying the convention could be implemented. This is a book published in 2006 called Mining Justice, Laws That Deprive People with Mental Disability of Life and Liberty. And the proposals made in this book are consistent, I think, for the most part, with the convention, because what I propose in this book is that laws that deprive people of mental disability with liberty and property, of liberty and property, can no longer reference diagnosis, can no longer reference mental disability, but instead should be based on a focus on the precise dysfunctions or functions that the law considers legally relevant. Now, as you notice, this book was published in 2006, which coincidentally was the same year the convention came out. I have to confess, when I was writing this book and when the book was published, I did not know about the convention. I really only discovered it in the last several years. But happily, as I've said, the proposals I make in this book are consistent with what the convention sets out. What I try to do in this book is set out specific statutory language that implements, as it turns out, the principles that are in the convention. In all the contexts that I talked about, civil commitment, guardianship, incompetency laws, the insanity defense. Okay? I essentially divided these various contexts into three different categories that you can see here on the left-hand side of the slide. The punishment model, or the punishment context, which basically involves the criminal justice system and where the insanity defense plays a significant role. The prevention model, which has to do with laws that involve preventive interventions, such as police power civil commitment, and laws that lead to commitment of sexually violent predators after their sentences are completed. And finally, laws that attempt to protect individuals, guardianship laws, incompetency laws, and so on. So in these three contexts, I tried to propose specific statutory language that implements the non-discrimination principles that the convention and the ADA propose. So let's start with the punishment model. What I suggested here, consistent with the convention, is that the insanity defense and all other special defenses based on mental disability be abolished, and that people with mental disability get the same defenses, but only those defenses that are available to people who do not have mental disability, assuming a criminal justice system that, as the convention suggests, is based on subjective criminal liability. So what does this mean? Well, let's say a person is charged with murder. What kinds of defenses would the person have? Under this statute you see here, there would be a defense for both a person with mental disability and a person without mental disability. If the person did not intend to kill, that's paragraph A, or under paragraph B, even if the person intended to kill, the person thought they were being threatened by deadly force by the victim, that's paragraph B, or under paragraph C, the person intended to kill, and was threatened by deadly force by a third party who said, if you don't kill this person, I will kill you. Basically what we call the duress defense. Okay. Now, I'm not going to be able to go into detail about this given time constraints, but just to give you an example or a flavor of how this statute would apply, you all know about the John Hinckley case. He was found not guilty by reason of insanity for trying to assassinate President Reagan. He would not have a defense under this statute. Why? Because even under the defense theory of that case, he intended to kill President Reagan, and his motivation was to impress Jodie Foster. Under no stretch of the imagination is it justifiable to kill a person, much less the President of the United States, in order to impress an actress. So he would not have a defense. On the other hand, Danny McNaughton, who you may know, his name, Grace, is the most famous insanity defense formulation, he probably would have a defense under this formulation. Why? because he tried to kill the Prime Minister of England, thinking the Prime Minister of England was trying to kill him. That is, the Prime Minister of England was trying to organize his minions to kill Danny McNaughton. So there's a lot more to say about this. It's a very controversial proposal. The point I want to make now is that this formulation does not differentiate between people with mental disability and people who do not have mental disability. I call it the integrationist test, as you can see from the top of the slide, because it integrates defenses for people with mental disability with defenses that are generally available to everyone. And that, I think, is consistent with the convention. So then, now let's go to the prevention model. This involves situations where the state is intervening preventively to detain an individual, to prevent harm from occurring. So there are basically three criteria here. The first is that no one can be subjected to preventive detention unless the criminal justice system does not have jurisdiction. What kinds of situations might that entail? A person who's been acquitted by reason of insanity and is considered dangerous. The criminal justice system no longer has jurisdiction over that person. Or a person with an infectious disease. The criminal justice system has no jurisdiction over that kind of person. Why? You cannot hold someone criminally responsible for a disease they couldn't help. Or an enemy combatant. The laws of war do not allow criminal prosecution of people who are involved in a lawful war. So those would be situations where preventive intervention would be allowed if two other predicates could be met. Secondly, the person has to be considered dangerous. Now, there is lots to be said about assessments of risk. I'm not going to get into that. It's a very fraught area. But let's assume we have sufficient proof of risk. The third requirement, which is the important one for our purposes, is that the risk has to be the result of what I call undeterrability. What do I mean by undeterrability? I define it very narrowly. You could argue that any recidivist is undeterrable, right? They've committed another crime, they've been undeterred by the criminal justice system. That's not what I mean by undeterrability. Undeterrability, as I define it, is very narrow. And it consists of three different situations that you see up here on the slide. The first type of undeterrability would be a person who is undeterrable because they literally do not think they're committing a crime at the time they commit it. That, for instance, might include someone who has psychosis, who is killing innocent people but thinking he's killing space aliens who are out to get him. That's a person who does not think he's committing a crime at the time he's committing it. Okay, or it could include enemy combatants. They don't think they're committing a crime at the time they're killing. Why? They're under orders to kill. The second kind of undeterrability is the kind of involves the kind of person who literally cannot prevent the kind of harm that they're causing. This might include, for instance, a person who psychiatrists say have automatisms. In other words, they have no control over their body, like a person with epileptic seizures. Or it also could include, as you see here, a person with contagious disease. That is an individual who literally cannot control the harm they cause because they cannot control the microbes that would infect people. The third kind of undeterrability is, as it says here, the kind of person who's willing to cause harm even if the person's apprehension and punishment, death or serious bodily injury, is highly likely result of that harm. The kind of person I have in mind here is perhaps a highly impulsive sex offender or a terrorist who's willing to kill for ideological reasons. This is the hardest kind of undeterrability to define, but it's probably best captured by the phrase that's often used in the insanity context. This is the kind of person who would cause harm even if a police officer was standing at his elbow. Now again, highly controversial, lots to talk about here. The only point I want to make is you'll notice that in all three of these areas, it applies both to people with mental disability and people who do not have mental disability. In other words, disability neutral criteria are being used. How much time do I have?
About 1 minute.
Okay. I'll finish with the protection model. And here I have a question mark because I'm not sure that my proposals here are as consistent with the convention as my proposals under the punishment and prevention model. And the reason my proposal might not be consistent is because the convention seems to say that even people with severe impairments should be allowed to make their own decisions. And I can't agree with that because I think, for instance, a person who's randomly nodding yes or no in response to questions should not be allowed to make decisions in whatever areas at issue because it's not reflecting a person's true desires and it's really making a mockery of the concept of autonomy no matter how many supportive personnel are trying to facilitate the issue. So as with many other thinkers, I would require under A that the person have a minimal understanding of the risks and benefits of the decision. And that we, as in B and C, inquire into the reasons for the person's decisions. But unlike many thinkers, I would only require that the person give a reason and that the person's reasons not be demonstrably false and that the person consider the pros and cons of the decision. You see, some definitions of competency focus on the idea of whether the decision is reasonable or whether the decision is consistent with what lawyers and doctors would decide. I do not take that approach. Instead, I require just a minimal understanding of the risks and benefits and that the reasons for acting not be delusional and that the individual not be so clinically depressed that the person is not actually willing to consider the risks and benefits. So I think I'll stop there. Thank you very much.